Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
60 seconds. That's exactly how long this commercial lasts. You know what else you can do in about a minute? Get an offer for your car with TrueCar. That's right. In the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, do a few sit-ups, or just listen to my voice, you can get a TrueCash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or home. Just go to TrueCar and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions and you'll get an accurate TrueCash offer from a local TrueCar certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in and they'll check it out with you together. You can ask questions and get the answers you need so there's no surprises. Then simply leave with your check or trade-in for your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out TrueCar today. Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marla Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide. Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
I want to start off today by thanking you for listening to this podcast. I'm a huge podcast fan. I find that by using the time when I'm driving in my car or exercising or even on a walk in a town I'm not necessarily familiar with, having that time to learn about things that I maybe wouldn't know about, like Guy Raz's podcast or Tim Ferriss's podcast or my next guest podcast, Script Notes. John August and Craig Mazin have an incredible podcast called Script Notes, which is probably primarily for writers, but I find as a working producer in Hollywood, it's completely invaluable to hear the insights and the thoughts and the things that are going through writers' minds in the current climate of the business, and more importantly, kind of how deeply they think about development and structure and character development. And I realized as I was listening, when I first became a development executive at the Walt Disney Company, yes, I had gone to a UCLA extension class on story development, and I had been an assistant for 2 years, listening on calls and reading a number of scripts, but I was not a trained writer. And suddenly I'm giving notes to very established writers. And I learned my craft over the next, 30 years to be better at development. But in those early years, I really didn't know what I was doing. I was just going for my gut. Yes, I was in staff meetings. I was learning what the company wanted me to develop. But I wondered, as a working writer, someone in John August's resume, he was nominated for a BAFTA. He's written for Tim Burton. He just recently wrote Aladdin, which is inches away from crossing the $1 billion mark. What are some of the pitfalls that development executives fall into? What are some of the phrases or the catchwords that really rub working writers the wrong way? Because I want the relationship between development execs and producers and writers to go more smoothly. I want development to be better. I hope from this podcast that with my guests that people are learning how to be better at their craft. And so I have John August on today, and we really deep dive into a number of things in development that drive writers crazy. Some of the words and catchphrases that development execs use that aren't necessarily as effective as they can be. And I hope if you're on either side as a writer or a development executives, that this talk today is insightful and that we can all learn some of the things that drive really, really smart, intelligent writers crazy and then not do them. Enjoy.
When your favorite show ends, Rob Sister Nino is just getting started with post-show recaps on Podcast One.
Sign me up.
Join him for live interactive podcasts right after episodes of your favorite shows like Big Little Lies and Star Trek Discovery, plus Netflix original shows like Stranger Things and so much more.
I want to see Stranger Things in the big cité. I want some Chicago redemption.
Okay, another Dick Wolf production, Chicago Stranger Things.
Yes.
Download new episodes of post-show recaps every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Alexa isn't the only one with breaking news. Make sure to hang around at the end of this podcast for the latest breaking headlines on the AP News Minute.
This is The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
All right, I'm here with John August. Hi, John.
Hello, how are you?
Man, thanks for doing this. I feel like not only you're an amazing writer, but I'm such a fan of your podcast, Script Notes. I feel like I'm in the presence of a huge celebrity.
So it's very weird being on the other side of the table. I'm usually the person asking questions, so I'll try to answer questions.
My guess is we'll ask each other questions, which is actually why I wanted to bring you on. You're obviously a hugely successful working writer in Hollywood. You've been nominated for everything, and you've been nominated for a Grammy.
I wrote lyrics to the Willy Wonka song,
which is amazing. And you've obviously worked with Tim Burton quite a bit.
Yeah.
Your podcast is called Script Notes. I want to talk to you about being a working writer in Hollywood, what that means. I figured since you have a podcast on screenwriting and I have a podcast on producing, maybe we can bridge the gap here, John.
Absolutely, that's right.
And so you are also a member of the WGA negotiating committee.
Mm-hmm.
You're in the leadership role there. And so just very quickly, not to talk about the ATA too much, but the writers have taken a stand and said, hey, we don't feel the agents are necessarily working in our best interest at all times when packaging fees for television are involved, that there might be some conflict of interest there because potentially you could make more money in the packaging fees than by representing us, and that might be a conflict of interest. Is that a fair—
Absolutely. Conflict kind of interest is really at the center of it. So it's,
right.
You know, packaging fees in television are classically sort of a thing we look at, but as agencies have become producers, that is the most classic kind of conflict of interest where they are literally employing you. So the action is to take a look at realigning our relationship so that we can make sure that our agents are really representing our best interests and not their own.
And I would say the same thing about managers,
mm-hmm.
correct? I mean, there are managers that represent writers and represent actors that are in name and job being producers. Do you feel that's a conflict of interest as well?
You know, we're approaching this as this is a concern that members brought to us. And so as we talked to our members about their relationships with their agents, they had huge concerns, and they made it clear anecdotally, but also just in surveys, like these are their concerns. We don't hear the same concerns from our members about managers. And so that's why we're focusing on agents.
Because ostensibly, the idea of a manager becoming a producer for a writer and or a piece of talent is you don't have to pay me commission. I'll get a producing fee from the buyer, and I will then protect you and your vision as a producer going forward, both either as a writer, director, actor. I'll be on the movie to make sure that your original intent is seen to the end, correct?
Yeah. And I've never had a manager, and so it's good to talk with you because you've come at this from a producing perspective.
Yeah.
And I've never really understood that function of a manager as that person who's going to be, you know, both a person who is, you know, representing your creative instincts and interests and is going to make the movie. So it's never a thing I've had. But as I talk to younger members, they've found managers to be invaluable. And so they feel like, often they need to have a manager on their side. So it's a different thing generationally than what I encountered.
For sure. I think it's interesting because it has evolved, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see these big management companies all have production credits on these big TV series that their clients have created. And also in terms of the actors, I think that if a manager is willing to be on set and willing to do the work, like Chris Bender is a perfect mm-hmm. example of a guy who works with writers, and he really works with them. He really develops the material, sends it out. When it's appropriate, he'll partner. When it's not, he'll do it himself. And he goes on set and he takes it all the way through. I think that's great. Where I start to get concerned just in terms of my job, because one of the reasons I did this podcast is I think the producer credit has been so devalued over the years that it's very the waters are very murky about what a producer does. And I think if a manager just is there to not have his client pay commission just so they can get a credit, that's problematic. I feel that way about anybody, so that's not specific to managers. If anybody's not on set doing the actual work, then I don't really consider them a producer. I wish there was another credit that we could give them. Unfortunately, there's not. We sort of have as many hyphens on a producer as possible. It would never work with co-exec screenwriter. You know, that's why your guild is so much better than the PGA in terms of just discerning credit and arbitration and that kind of thing.
Well, the Writers Guild is a true labor organization. We are a union, and so we can do some things that a Producers Guild can't. A Producers Guild is a voluntary body of people who are coming together to hopefully form better standards for things, but is a very different structure. I would say way back, 90, 96, 97 is when I started my blog, and people would write in with questions, and I would try to answer their questions. And one of the earliest questions I got is like, what do all these producer credits mean?
Right.
And you try to explain it, and it's really, really tough.
Well, because you can't even explain it inside of an executive producer's thousands of different things.
No.
So let's go through. Let's talk about, for people out there that are screenwriters or people that are out there that are producers or execs that listen to this or even agents that listen to this, I want to go through with you because I've never done this. I've never gone through like, okay, John, you come up with an idea. Let's take that all the way through to the premiere, which is congratulations on Aladdin.
Thank you.
You were a writer on that movie and you just recently went to the premiere. So I want to talk about going to premieres and our different experiences. And let's just walk through how you and I work together and how you would work with execs. And let's start with an idea, and let's start with your relationship with your agent when you had one, and you will have one again. So when you come up with an idea, you find an article, whatever, walk me through the process of a working writer in Hollywood. What's the first thing you do?
So there are really two different categories of projects. One's where I'm completely initiating the idea, where like I have the idea to do this thing. So my first movie, Go, was an example of like, it was wholly my idea. I'd written the script. I took it to my agent, said, this is a script. Let's try to sell this script and find the right home for it.
You had already written it on spec.
100%.
With no...
Nothing was attached.
Right.
Just 100% just me. So that is the most classic situation where we call it a spec script because no one was paying you to write it, and you own it 100%. And so there, your job of working with your agent is to find out who is the right buyer for this project and hopefully who's the buyer who will not only pay you the money but will actually get the project made.
That is so important because I do feel like in the spec boom, a lot of that got lost.
Yeah.
A lot of the strategy of, okay, who is the best person to get this movie made? And I've used the movie Enchanted a bunch of times, that was a spec that went out. And it was based – a Disney princess comes out of the Disney animated movies and goes to New York City. And I was like, well, no one else can make that movie. Like, well, Warner Brothers could. And I go, they don't have an animation. Like, this is impossible. And thank God we got it. But it always seems so short-sighted when writers and or agents say, well, I don't care. F*** it. I'm just going to sell it to the highest bidder.
Yeah.
So that strategy is hugely important. And when you're working with your agent and you're thinking about those things, like what kind of things come into consideration? Is it the executive? Is it the type of person? Is it the marketing? What is it that makes you make your decision of where you're going to put your projects?
Is this a place that actually can and will make this movie? And so Enchanted is a great example. Like, they are the only place that can do that. Saving Mr. Banks, only Disney can make that movie. A lot of other projects, anyone can make them. And so if you have a horror script, like, is Blumhouse the right place to make that? Because they make a very specific kind of thing. Is that their thing? Then maybe great. Maybe that's exactly the right place for it. So you have those conversations about what is the right home for it? Who is the person who will really get it and will champion it? Who is the person who's going to keep you involved in the project? Is not just going to sort of take, okay, we bought this thing, and now let's bring in John August to rewrite it. Like, you want the place that's going to see the vision for the movie and actually keep you involved with the vision for the movie through the whole time.
Well, and now you also have to think about what kind of format it's going to go out on.
Yeah.
So you have to think, is this a theatrical play or is this better on streaming? And then there's now multiple streaming services as well as a theatrical play. And then Blumhouse is an interesting example to dive into a little bit deeper, because the other thing you have to consider is what kind of deal are you looking for? So Blumhouse has a very specific kind of structure. I had Jason on the podcast, and he has a very specific structure in his deal making. Very filmmaker friendly in terms of the creative process, but at the end of the day, you're sharing the profit, at the end of the day with him, because you're having the benefit of his brand. Does that come? So walk me through kind of that consideration, like theatrical versus streaming. You haven't not yet done anything for Netflix, but obviously, Christopher McQuarrie was on your show the other day, and he's got something now at Netflix. Yeah. What would go through your mind if you were a young writer? Because we both do this for the same reason, which is to educate people and hope to give people an insight, lifting the veil a little bit on our business to give people a leg up to have a chance to succeed better. So if you're a young writer or a young producer, how would you make that decision right now versus streaming versus theatrical? Or would you just sort of kind of go out there and kind of – and would your preference always be to go theatrical first if you are a young writer, not someone of your of your stature at this point?
So in 2019, I've written a script that I could go in multiple directions. It could be a major theatrical release with a full studio backing. It could be an indie film, or it could be streaming.
Right.
I think I would take an honest assessment over who makes this movie and how many chances are there that it's going to be a big theatrical, whether it could find a slot in an indie or if it really wants to be a streaming. I think it is important to get a thing made. And getting a thing made, I think, is much more common and easy right now in 2019 on streaming than it is theatrically.
Sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Especially for somebody who's just writing something on spec.
Completely.
Because you talk about a lot on your podcast, and we do here as well. The theatrical experience has obviously shifted, and not a lot. Aladdin came to you, So there's only a certain amount of people that are getting the bites of that apple, that big Disney, tentpole apple. So it's most likely going to be, if somebody's coming out and creating something from whole cloth, unless they got lucky and found some incredible piece of IP, it's most likely going to be either independent or streaming.
Yeah.
So you just have to be honest about that in terms of, swinging for the fences and where to place your project.
Well, we're talking about high class problems. So it's like, oh my gosh, should I take this huge deal from Paramount or should I go to Netflix? Like, lovely problems to have. But let's say you have that lovely problem. You are going to ask yourself, do I think Paramount's really going to make this movie? Now, you and I both came up in a time when, studios were developing a ton of stuff and then they were picking a few things to make.
For sure.
They're still making things. Now they develop so much less, they make so much less, that if you're going to be one of those projects, you have to really be honest. Do you think they're going to pull the trigger and make that movie for, $80 million and spend another $50 million on P&A? If it's the right kind of idea, yes. Maybe it's a giant tentpole idea, great. But if it's not, I think, looking at making it for streaming does tend to make more sense.
Because that is something that when you've written something and you're talking to your agent, the thing to ask your agent is the real honest assessment of the marketing, because that is the whole difference between any of the streamers and now even them, right? Mm-hmm. So Disney Plus, Warner streaming, all that is the P&L. Mm-hmm. And that marketing cost, the domestic marketing cost combined with the international marketing cost, is the whole difference of getting your movie made or not, possibly.
Yeah.
And the weight that throws on top of your project, both getting it made to get the green light and also to make any money on it in any sort of back end, because that was always the knock on Netflix, is that there's not a back end. So that's obviously all gone away, because very few back ends ever pay off. And that's not anything to do with anybody, cooking the books or whatever. It's just the reality of how much it costs to make and market a movie. That is also a really honest – you have to be honest with yourself of, do you think this is going to support a $50 million ad spend?
But there's also a creative aspect you have to keep in mind. It's not just like, I have this vision of seeing it on a big screen. It's that I have a vision of people seeing it at all. And I do talk to a lot of filmmakers who they sold their movie out of Sundance to Netflix or to wherever, and it just disappears. Right. I mean, it technically is available, but no one has ever seen it. And so there's something to be said for the model that actually, like, where you're doing the press, you're doing all the stuff, you're just putting it out there in the world. So there's actually, sort of proof that your movie exists. And so you want it to be made, but you also want it to be seen by people. Right. And for certain kinds of projects, Netflix is exactly the right place to see that. And I think you have to be as honest with, your genre assessment and sort of like what elements you have there. Like, is it going to be a thing that can find its audience on Netflix, be that financially a windfall or just creatively a windfall that, like, the right people found it?
And when you mean people seeing it, do you mean audiences, or do you mean people in the business that could further your career later? Because there's kind of two mm-hmm. parts to that statement, right? The first part is obviously people are seeing stuff on Netflix, and they'll never give us the real numbers, but the opportunity for 100 million people to watch it is there. There's 100 million subscribers; any one of them can click on your movies. Therefore, the pool is very wide and deep. Mm-hmm. But the other part of that is most of the big events on Netflix up until now on the movie side were driven by theatrical. So you would have a big, cool, theatrical, splashy ad campaign that Netflix would benefit from. They would put it out and you go, oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah, that's right. I want to see that. All the Disney movies. Like, now I can see it on Netflix. That's gone away because all of the sellers have taken their movies off of Netflix. So now it's just a self-perpetuating marketing mm-hmm. you know, through Netflix. And it feels like the movies that pop for us, like in the business, are things like, you know, Ali Wong's
Miranda
Parks, Always Be My Baby is like, oh, there it is. There's the, you know, the new thing. I hear it's good, even though nobody's seen it. And so is that what you're talking about?
That is exactly what I'm talking about. So like you look at Always Be My Maybe, which, you know, has primarily Asian American cast. And you feel like what's great about that movie existing on Netflix is everybody who really wants to see that movie can watch that movie on day one. It can be part of the cultural conversation right from the start. But contrast it with Crazy Rich Asians, which also has that thing. And they had the chance to go to Netflix and they decided, you know what? We're going to make a big theatrical play for this. And we're going to go to the place that is going to spend a little less money up front, but we think we can get the theatrical boost out of it. And they were absolutely right.
Yeah.
So there's not one way it automatically works that.
But for the filmmaker, mm-hmm. and just in terms of practically, just in terms of furthering your career, for the filmmaker,
for John Chu, it's better.
Well, for John Chu, it's better, for sure. But I'm saying, in generally, these new young filmmakers, it used to be, practically now, mm-hmm. it used to be, I hear John's movie's really good. Can I see it? Now the studio won't let you see it. You got to wait for it to come out theatrical. Then I got to get in my car. I got to go down and do it. If I miss it, mm-hmm. then I got to wait because the DVD hasn't come out yet. It's very hard to get a link because the studio's holding it back. With Netflix, you're like, cool, I can watch it and I can hire the guy the next day. So there's something to be said for that if you can get the right eyeballs on it.
Yeah.
And so that's also an interesting factor of it too. It's like when I made a deal with a DP mm-hmm. and the very first Netflix movie I did was right after Sandler had done it. And the DP and I got into not an argument, but mm-hmm. I thought it was hilarious where the agent was like, he needs a DVD copy of the movie. And I'm like, no. And like, what do you mean no? It's on Netflix.
Yeah.
Anybody could click on it at any time. You don't need a DVD in your deal anymore.
Yeah.
Like, here you go. Here's the link. Watch it. And it was like a weird concept for this DP that has been working for years in the business. It was like, holy shit. That's right. Anybody can watch it at any time. So there is that to consider when you're a young mm-hmm. filmmaker trying to figure out where to put your movie to it. People have access to it instantaneously that can hire you the next day. Mm-hmm. So you had a really interesting podcast about genres that have gone away. And so that's another thing to consider. Now, so let's talk about your relationship with your agent then at that point. You've given – you say these young filmmakers really rely on their managers. Can you walk me through like what that relationship is like with your with a young filmmaker, with their manager and their agent? Like what is that relationship, the creative relationship like?
All right. So
what should it be?
I think it should be a discussion of both long-term and short-term goals. Like, what is it you're trying to do? When I talk to folks who have managers, the managers tend to be reading every draft and really making it clear that, you know, they are, you know, helping to shape sort of like what that thing is and sort of position it that right way. Whereas agents tend to have really good connections everywhere and have a good sense of what all the different buyers want and sort of like what are the deals that are possible, because hopefully they're making a ton of deals so they get a sense of what's out there and what's going to happen.
And what are the needs of all the different people that can kind of steer you in the right direction of what, you know, what people are looking for?
So let's wind all the way back to Go, my first movie. So this is 96. But I think in some ways it's still representative of that kind of classic spec sale, which is here's the list of all the potential buyers. Here are the people, the producers generally, who we think are the right producers to take it into that place.
Okay, so that's perfect. Walk me through those decisions. Like, was it because they were powerful, or because they thought you would see eye to eye creatively, or they were hot and they just made their deal at the studio, so people were buying for them? What was the determining factor in terms of placing you with a producer specifically before you went to the buyer?
All of the above. So a producer who that agent feels like could get along with, who would understand the project, who would really be able to champion it, where it wouldn't be like just like one more thing mm-hmm. they're pushing in that week to put on the weekend read. Someone who would really get it. Because an agent is always going to be mindful of most of these places are not going to actually buy it, but they want to make sure these producers are reading this material because this is a new writer that they should be on their list. And so that's part of the game too, is that it's not just about selling the script. It's about starting putting that writer in conversation with those producers about stuff.
So it's a relationship that hopefully will last a long time, and they can consistently employ you down the line, and you know that they're going to fight for your vision and your material.
And that was 100% the case with Go, because we sent it out with producers at all these different places. No one bought it, and the consistent, you know, word back was, we really, really like this. We could never make this movie, but let's have a meeting with John. And so I would go in and I would do the water bottle tour of Los Angeles and sort of sit down with all these folks, and we could talk about this script and like what they saw in this script. When it was useful, because you can read Go and say like, oh, it looks like a comedy, it looks like a drama, it looks like an action movie, like whatever people wanted to see in it, they could see in it, and they would think of me for other projects. And so after a while in that meeting, they pull out the list of things that they're working on, and maybe I'm right for that. And it sort of got me my first, you know, dialogue polishes and just like little bits of production work, which were so helpful, because at that point I had sold to other, I'd done two other adaptations, but I didn't have anything made. I hadn't sort of done the piecework of Hollywood at that point, and it sort of got me on the list for that.
But, well, those are known as general meetings, right? Yeah. So you would come in on a general meeting. So for, you know, everybody who is on the other side, like an executive out there listening or a young producer out there listening, what would you love to happen in a general meeting? What do you expect, and what do you, when you leave a general meeting, do you go, that was a good meeting?
So a sense that they have read what I wrote.
That's good. That's a good start.
That they see me as a certain kind of writer, or if their perceptions are incorrect, that I'm able to sort of steer them in the right place over it. That if they're sort of doing that soft pitch in the room of different projects, you know, they may have two or three that they really think I'm probably right for, but give me the longer list, because I've generally found it's the things that are deeper on that list. It's like, oh, I know exactly how to do that.
That's
the one to do. Because Aladdin is an example of that, where like they were bringing me in for a completely different set of like priorities, and then they got to Aladdin like, oh, no, stop. I know how to do this. And, you know, we could immediately make it happen. So, you know, I would say be there ready to talk, but also really ready to listen and be responsive in the room to sort of the things that can come up.
And do you find that a lot of producers and executives, when you come in, go, what do you got?
Yeah.
And they don't have anything for you. They just want to see what you have. And then that seems to me like the feedback I get from writers on those general meetings that are bad are when A, they haven't read your script. Yeah. That's bad. But B, that they just go, okay, what do you got? What can you give me? And it needs to definitely be a give and take, if not just a take, of mm-hmm. somebody coming and going, you're the writer. I can't do it without you. I have to be able to present you a number of things that could at least spark a dialogue or something down the line.
Absolutely. So it doesn't have to be – classically, it was that Buck slip that said, like, you know, the 19 different Brian Grazer ideas that they're always trying to fill. It doesn't have to be so specific, or it doesn't have to be like a piece of IP, but let us know specifically what kind of thing it is you're looking for. What is the shape of movie that you're trying to make? Because that's incredibly helpful. So if I'm going in to talk with Nina Jacobson, I should hopefully have some sense of the things that interest her in general based on sort of other things she's made. But if there's a specific thing that she's trying to find, that's really helpful, because then I can be going in thinking what that is, or I can follow up with like, oh, I just read this thing, which was great. Here's a way to do that.
Right. And okay, so – and your agent has hopefully put you with people that you think you get along with. And mm-hmm. and beyond getting along with them, it's sort of a dig in creatively. They know this person's going to roll up their sleeves and be there with you and not just bully you and not just try to beat you up, but listen and give you hopefully good notes.
You can't know that off of a first meeting. I mean, your agent will hopefully have some sense of what that is, but they honestly don't know, because everyone's experience is slightly different. I think what's gotten so much better over the last 20 years is that writers do talk to each other. So we will have casual conversations and we'll figure out, like, please give me the scoop on this person. Like, is it just me or does this happen to everybody?
Right.
And the answer is it usually does happen to everybody.
For sure.
So there's definitely executives around town and producers around town, which writers know, okay, if you're going to take that job, know going in, these are the problems you're going to face.
Right. And so that's perfect. So let's go to development now. Now you've sold – your agent has mm-hmm. successfully sold your material. Actually, before we get to development, what's that like? What's that
– the sale?
Yeah. What's that like on your side? I know what it's like on my side is that, you know, I'm hoping I get it. Mm-hmm. I've been in a number of situations where it's been multiple bidders, which is really fun, and I can always try to help steer the writer where I – if it's something that I have the whole town for, steer the writer where I think it is best suited. But walk me through like a spec sale if you can remember. Like what was that like?
So way back in the 90s.
I know, when there used to be spec sales.
So way back
what
in the 90s.
What was it like for a writer?
Back in the 90s, there were auctions, and it was exciting, and, you know, multiple bidders would go for things, and, you know, people burst in. It's like, you know, it's going to get $1 million for this and, you know, against this. And it was exciting because things were being talked up. I never had that in sort of script land. So like Go, we found the right buyer for, but it was this tiny company called Banner, producer named Mickey Liddell, who could sit down with me and say, like, listen, I cannot pay you a lot for this, but I promise you'll stay involved through the whole thing. I believed him, and he was completely right. But that wasn't a situation where I had, where my agent had even really an experience or exposure with him. It's like it was kind of a flyer, and it was a flyer that worked out. Where I have had that option situation with Arlo Finch, the book series I write, then my agent Jody Reamer could take it out to, again, the buyers who she thought were right. So in this case, you're sending it to editors rather than sending it to producers, but those people are then going to take it into their house and sort of get stuff bid. And it is exciting because you get 20 minutes later, there's a new phone call from a new place. And like,
right.
And then you're weighing between what we said before, not just what is the most money, but what is the right place for it? What is the place that actually gets the book or the movie and has a way to sort of put it in the right place, that has the right team that can not only get the book creatively where it wants to get to, but can actually push it, through all the channels. So you have those conversations, and that's where an expert really is helpful.
Well, what advice do you give to young writers when they're faced with that situation, which mm-hmm. is like obviously a dream and few and far between? Because I know a lot of writers, a lot, that have sold multiple scripts for $1 million and have not gotten a movie made.
Yeah.
So what advice do you give young writers in the guild and when you're doing these panels and these talks and you get these questions? What's the advice for somebody who's like in a situation where more than one place wants their script and it might be like life-changing money, but what would you say to them is the most important thing to consider when you're going to sell your project?
Life-changing money is great. And so if there's a seven-figure deal to buy your script, you're going to take that seven-figure deal, but also at the same time be looking at all the other places who didn't buy there and really try to get a project set up there. Try to be hired to write for other folks. And like, don't look at it as a lottery ticket where this is the one, it's going to change everything, because it yeah. never is the one lottery ticket. Like, Go was a really successful movie for me, but it was all the other stuff I was writing at the same time that actually made my career.
Right.
It's that people don't hire scripts, people hire writers, and make sure that you are a writer that they want to hire.
Well, that's the story on John Chu and Nina when they chose to put Crazy Rich Asians with Warners, is they turned down a lot more money in a three-picture deal at Netflix because they did want to see – they felt it was important to have all of this represented on the big screen, and they knew that that would pay off longer in the long run in terms of just the whole business and the health of the business for yeah. the Asian community yeah. specifically. So, okay, you've sold your script mm-hmm. to the right place, hopefully.
Yep.
Now let's go into the most fun part, which is this is where you and I sit on both sides of the couch mm-hmm. and the development process.
Yeah.
What do we not know? What do you guys talk about as writers, as producers and studio executives, especially young studio executives? What do we need to know to be the best we can be for you mm-hmm. and be the most effective at getting the best out of you and yet servicing what our bosses need and what the studio as a whole needs in order to get the movie made in the way that the studio is happy, but we don't blow the relationship with you and we get the best out of you and don't just churn and burn through you?
I think no matter what your note is, you need to express it in positive terms. And by positive, I don't mean happy. I mean positive. I mean this is what moves us forward to making this into a movie. Because remember that you are reading a script, you're reading a bunch of 12-point courier, but in the writer's head, that is a representation of a movie that the writer sees inside his or her head. And so whatever note you're giving, recognize that they will probably be willing to make that change if they believe that it actually gets this movie off the page and into production and into a finished form. So sometimes when you see what looks like resistance from a writer, it's because they are doing all the mental work to change this movie in their mind to see if it can actually accommodate this suggestion that you're making. So just be positive, be patient, and recognize that it's a lot of work happening behind the eyes for every note you get. And sometimes it's like such a simple note. Like, why are they freaking out over that? It's because it's connected to things that you can't see because of how the whole thing is constructed in their head. The script is just a written representation of a movie that they see.
Right. When I started at Disney in those early days, Disney was the worst. Mm-hmm. We would give 20 pages of notes.
Oh, yeah.
Single-spaced. Yeah. And I remember just the drafts of the notes and working on the notes, and it was just honestly 90% bullshit. Mm-hmm. 90% was the same shit we were saying, regurgitating over and over again. And there was just this feeling, I was a CE and a director of development, of like, are we just trying to listen to ourselves talk? Are we just bullshitting these people? And so I distilled it down, and let's talk about it, because maybe I'm wrong and maybe there's a better way to do it. I distilled it down to what, why, how. Mm-hmm. Because we would do these paragraphs and paragraphs of the issue and these verbose just, you know, thoughts. And I said, basically, what, why, how? What's the problem? Why is it a problem? Mm-hmm. And how do we fix it? Mm-hmm. And give a suggestion of how you would fix mm-hmm. it, and that which should spark conversation. And then the notes that come out of that meeting should be the notes that we go and accomplish. And so I would, when I became a VP and then a senior VP, I made the CEs do that. I said, don't give me anything other than what, why, how. Don't say anything else. Try it. Just do it in three lines. And it was great for meetings to mm-hmm. be able to just have honest conversations of what I thought what we thought the problem was mm-hmm. and why we felt it was a problem. And then here's a suggestion of how we would fix it. Maybe that would help you. Do you think that's helpful?
Well, you're expressing things in terms of feeling, which is good because it acknowledges that it's a subjective experience that you're having to, you know, the thing that you read. And so there's no objective truth behind it. It's just like, this is the feeling that you're having, and this is, you know, why you think you're having this feeling. This is where you think this problem is occurring, and that can spark a conversation. It's when you when you sort of move from subjective reality to objective reality, like, oh, this is clearly the problem.
That's important. That is so important, because I do feel, and I think maybe it's driven by insecurity. I do feel, and I got to say, I'm positive I have done this mm-hmm. in my career. The insecurity of a feeling and not knowing if, and you have a gut feeling, but not knowing if you're going to be taken seriously or have the final word, sometimes then does come across as absolutes.
Oh, yeah.
Like, well, this is it. This is, the studio feels this way. Mm-hmm. And this is not even feels. This is it. This is the problem. The studio has this problem, and you better fix it. As opposed to, in my gut, I'm having this uh-oh feeling of this moment or whatever it is. Like you said, there was a moment in Aladdin mm-hmm. that you'd have taken out. It's just an uh-oh feeling, right? It's like, it doesn't feel right. It's breaking the flow of this thing. My, you know, and specifically, you said it was a character that did a bad deed to show he was a bad guy. Yeah. And so that's all we can do is just go, this is how I feel. But I do think that I would imagine, and I was, when I was a young creative executive, I wanted to be smart. And
yeah.
I wanted to be taken seriously. And I always say, would you rather be right or good? Mm-hmm. You know, and so sometimes those things don't go together. And I as I've gotten older, and especially in the last, since I've become an independent producer and nobody listens to me anyway, yeah. I'd rather be good than right. Yeah. And so I think that's so smart of just express it as feelings and not absolutes.
Yeah. Because obviously we've been living with this story for a long time. So you are one of the first people reading it, one of the first people who's having to recreate this movie in their head based on what we did. And so if there are things that don't click for you, talk to us about that they weren't clicking, and let's see if we can figure out together how to make them click. I mean, I'm always excited to work on a note that, like, oh, I never saw it that way, or I never understood that that's why you were seeing it that way. Let me work on that so it doesn't happen for other people. That's fantastic. But again, if you can express these things not defensively, like, you know, we have to pare back to protect ourselves, and rather than sort of more optimistically, like, this is how we're going to make the best movie of all time, that's, you know, that gets us excited to get back to the next draft.
Do you feel like most executives deliver the notes in that way, that we're going to make the best movie of all time, or it is, let me just try to stop the bleeding here
yeah,
I feel like I can protect my bonus?
I feel like there's a lot of protection.
Right?
Yeah, and it's frustrating. And I get it, because people genuinely are concerned about their jobs. They're concerned about sort of, you know, all the things that could go wrong. But you can't try to micromanage the movie while you're just looking at the script stage. And so often I think the writer is being tasked with responsibility for things that are really beyond the writer's purview. And, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do every department's job right here, right now. Just like, let's share a vision for what we want to make. But there's going to be so much hard work ahead. So we can't try to fix everything on the page when it's not a page issue.
I would imagine, I know, it's an incredibly vulnerable thing to write and to turn something into somebody and to give that over to somebody else. Even for you now, as f***ing John August, do you still have it when you're like turning in a script? Is it still a vulnerable thing? Or are you like, I know this is right. Let's discuss how to make it better. And if you're a young writer, is that a better approach? Which I would argue it probably is.
Yeah. I think for younger, newer writers, sometimes you just generally don't know sort of like what's on the page is going to work in somebody's head or not. I think with experience, I get a much better sense of that. So I don't know whether they're going to love it, but I know that what I'm doing actually does track and make sense. And so that you get over some of that fear. And also, I've certainly had enough movies made that I have a good sense of like, okay, this on the page becomes that in the movie. I know that they are actually connected. And when you're first starting out as a writer, you're not really quite sure the degree to which does that line of dialogue actually work when an actor says it. And you get more comfortable with that just with experience.
And I would say that the death of development is when a writer assumes they know what the studio wants and just tries to deliver that as opposed to what's best for this specific story. And I also feel on the flip side, executives a lot try to do things they've already done. Like, well, this has worked in the past, so I'm going to try to shoehorn this movie into something that we just had a hit on, you know, a year ago or 6 months ago. Let's try to make it more like this movie. And if the writer and the executive are doing that, because I remember when Nina and I were co-presidents of production, we would get scripts that felt like they were trying to give us what we wanted as opposed to what was best for the movie. And that would really frustrate us. And especially if people don't have an innate ability for specific thing like you're a great comedic writer. If somebody's not funny and they're trying to please you and trying to tell you what's funny, it's never going to work. It's got to come from you and a very honest place. It's the same thing with budgets too, where as a producer, I've given people first drafts, executives first drafts, and they're like, well, it's too expensive. I'm like, well, f*** you. How do you know?
Yeah.
How do we know how much this movie's going to cost? A, we haven't budgeted it. And B, you haven't even done a P&L.
No.
Like, you're already worried because there's a real fun, big action set. That's the thing that also freaks me out is when all these things come into the room, the politics, the, you know, oh, we just had a staff meeting where now we need this kind of movie, and they try to put it in there. Really blows up the whole process.
Yeah. I would say another thing which happens too early in the movie process is like, oh, but this actor or that actor. And I think it happens less now. I think it was much more of a thing like,
For sure.
We won't be able to get this A-list star. I'm happy that we've moved beyond a little of that right now, but that also becomes a thing where it's like you've stopped, like everything was, you had a certain set of priorities going into this, and then once a new element comes attached, like that director or that actor, suddenly all previous development, all previous decisions are unmade because this new person is involved. And
right.
That is really, really tough for a writer. It's like, oh, this was incredibly important until it's not important at all anymore.
So besides speaking from a feeling place and not an absolute place, what have been some of the best experiences you've had in development? You have to be don't give specific people, but just in terms of this has been a joy because – and but by the way, my movie might have bombed, but just the experience of working and growing as a writer and having this relationship with a producer and executive. Talk to me from a writer's perspective what you're looking for in a producer – and or executive to really make you the best you can be and really feel like it's a collaborative effort to have the best shot to give you your best work.
Yeah, I've talked about this before, but with Big Fish, it was just me and the book. And so I'd read the book, set up the book at Sony. I had to go off and do the Charlie's Angels movie and other stuff, but I finally got a chance to go back and actually write the script. And I was really happy with the script. And it did a lot of what I wanted to do. I knew it was good, but it was also a very expensive, tiny movie. There were a lot of barriers in the way of getting it made, and had the unique choice and opportunity to just find producers. And so I called Dan Jenks and Bruce Cohen, who had just done American Beauty, which was another comparatively expensive, really successful movie. And I said, like, hey, would you read this? Would you sign on? And they said yes. And to have the right producers on a project who could see, like, okay, this is the vision, and most of this works. Here are some moments where it's not working for us, and let's talk about the what ifs and how we could get to the next place. And to have people that I felt like genuinely understood the movie I was trying to make was just so comforting and reassuring that I didn't have to worry that dumb choices were going to be made for expediency rather than what was best for the movie.
And why they were they are so great, they're not a team anymore, was Bruce was an AD for Spielberg and knew really what movies cost and how to do it. And Dan used to work for Marty Bregman. Like he saw producing in the nuts and bolts of the mean streets of of the Marty Bregman world. And so those guys, when those guys came together, plus they're just the sweetest, smartest, nicest guy, where I did The Forgotten with him. And they together could not – there's no bullshit. It wasn't like some pie in the sky theoretical of a producer going, well, I think that's going to cost $100 million. You don't really know how much it's going to cost. So just don't bring that up. Those guys were really, really good and now separately – just sort of honing in on, okay, John, let's make, like you said, let's make the best movie possible out of this. Now, since you mentioned Charlie's Angels, what's been the worst?
The sequel.
Well, let's talk about what went wrong there, like without getting specific execs or names, but like when it's bad, A, you must know, you must feel, because you're in the guild and you talk to all these people, typically what goes wrong.
Yeah.
And typically, where are the things we as producers and executives, what can we avoid so that you don't have a bad experience?
So the sequel Charlie's Angels is a fascinating example because the first movie was really tough to make, and I'm really happy with the first movie, but it was a slog to make that movie, and there was a lot of, you know, I always described it as being fighting the monster, and you were never quite sure who the monster was going to be on a given day. Some days it was me. But like every day you wake up like, we got to fight the monster. Who's the monster going to be?
Right.
And so going into the sequel, we were all really happy with the first movie. Going into the sequel, I made a list of like, okay, let's not do these things. And like it was recognizing that sequels have their own innate problems just, you know, as a form and sort of as a process. And so it's like, let's take it back to sort of the basics. Let's really be clear on what it is we're trying to do, because what my vision for it was that in some ways the first Charlie's Angels was like that really difficult pilot, and then like the second episode, it would be like the second episode of a series that cost like $100 million that you made every 3 years. But you learn so much after shooting a pilot that like that second episode can be really good because you actually finally know what it is you're trying to make. And so I made this little checklist of like, let's not have Cameron dancing in every scene. Like, let's not do all the escalation of things that we normally do in sequels. And it became ultimately, you know, ironically, the checklist of like, let's do all these things.
Well, you put it on paper so that people believe everything they read.
and so it was the challenge of really having two very different visions for sort of what the movie was going to be. And then trying to combine them. Basically, we developed two completely separate storylines, and at the last minute tried to shuffle them together, and it didn't work. It was overstuffed in the wrong ways and didn't get back to sort of the fundamentals of sort of what it wanted to be. And yet there's still delightful moments in it, but it ended up being a really frustrating process.
I think that's such a good point, because I think probably just from a sky-high view of what can – the worst thing you can do is have a different movie in your head and in my head, right? So if I have a movie in my head and you have a different movie in your head, it's never going to work.
Yeah.
But beyond that, just in terms of like being in a room and feeling like, ugh, this sucks, what can we avoid as producers? What are the buzzwords? What are the things that sometimes you hear that we say that are just like, he doesn't know what the f*** he's talking about. He's just talking now. So – what are those things that we can avoid, specifically for young execs out there and anybody listening who wants to be a producer or an executive and actually have – or an agent and have an – or a manager and have an intelligent conversation with a writer? What are the things we can avoid saying or doing or coming in with a specific point of view as?
You know what? I mean, some of the words that always trigger me are confusing. It's going to be confusing for the audience. Impactful, just because I've never liked the word impactful. I get that it's a real word now, but that sense of, you know, there's always this desire to compress the first act down to sort of nothingness and to can we make this thing happen sooner and happen
get
faster?
Get to the inciting incident
quicker.
Yeah,
and so it's like, you know what? Sometimes you can, but you don't know how much of the stuff before that moment you're going to need in the actual movie to...
Raising Arizona.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's this desire to, you know, sort of get the movie done so fast and so early, but then ironically to extend the last set piece endlessly. And so those are the frustrations that you see as a writer. It's like, oh my God, they're gonna keep hammering me that they want more detail and more insight on this character in fewer pages, and it just doesn't actually happen or work. And so when I get brought in as to rewrite something, or just even as like a production polish, most of my job is just like stripping away all the coats of paint that were put on there based on probably really frustrating notes for the writer who had to deal with them.
Well, that's a great segue. So now you're lucky enough to get your movie made, mm-hmm. and you're in it now.
Yeah.
And you're making the movie.
Yep.
And now you're not just dealing with producers and agents and execs. You're dealing with directors and you're dealing with actors. Mm-hmm. What's that like as a working writer in Hollywood, being on set and doing this work with the steam train motoring along at 1,000 miles an hour, costing $200,000-$300,000 a day? Mm-hmm. What's that? What's the advice for me, mm-hmm. to help you do the best you can do? And what's your advice to a writer being in that situation, if they're lucky enough, if their movie's getting made, now you're suddenly on set? How do you navigate those waters? Because they can be pretty treacherous.
So if at all possible, as a producer, make sure that writer is there for the table read, because it is the last best chance to sort of do those small tweaks on things, or, wow, this performance is just not going to work, or, you know, have those honest conversations about, okay, you cast this actor who is not the part that I wrote, so I'm going to probably need to rewrite this part because it just does not make sense with this actor that you've cast. And I've had to do that. And if I'm there for the table read, it's so much better because I got to see them try the whole thing together. Once you're actually in production, or let's talk those last 2 weeks before pre-production, right before you're getting started. It's when you're figuring out those last locations, you're figuring out those last things, and sometimes just for expediency, schedules will change. You'll like, oh, this thing that was going to set here, it needs to be set here.
It's not a barn; it's a grocery store.
Like this was going to be a dom, but now it's at dusk.
Right.
And the writer is probably one of the few people there who really understood why things were a certain way, or sort of like how stuff was going to fit together. The director is busy doing 1,000 other things, so just including the writer in the distribution on that stuff and listening when he or she comes forward to say, like, okay, this could really be a problem. Let's make sure we really do see this, because it creates this logic issue that no one else is seeing here. That's a useful thing for the writer. Once it actually comes to time being on the set, it tends to be driven by the personality of the director and how confident the director is about having the writer around. There have been movies where I've been there for every frame shot, and between takes I can have a quick little conversation with the director about a thing I saw, an opportunity. Here's an alternate line. This is going to be challenging to match. So just how are you planning to get through this? It's hard to teach a writer how to recognize where those boundaries are. But there's been other times where, you know, I've been on set and I try to give that really simple note and clearly just got shut down. It's like, there's no point for me to even be here. And that's good too. Where a producer should absolutely use that writer is after that first cut, because there's going to be so much stuff that you have lived with this movie your whole time, and you know all the wars that fought, and like that you went into golden, like double golden overtime to get that last thing. We're just watching a movie, and we're saying like, okay, this isn't working here. Here are opportunities, and we're not precious about those things.
Right.
It's no longer our roles have reversed, and now we're just looking at like, given what I see here, this is the movie I think you can make.
Well, that's smart. The other thing I've started to do is when everybody gets there for rehearsal, because then everybody goes into separate rooms, and then things come out and you're like, what? What did you guys discuss? I have really made it a point to get at least the top three or four, I mean, depending on the movie, but let's say three or four, and Taggart was nine, and sit down in a room all around a table for 10 hours and go, let's do it. Let's go line by line and let's talk about it, because everybody then understands why the lines were written in the way they were written. By the way, it doesn't mean you can't improv. It doesn't mean you can't do it. But it's not like someone walking on set going, oh, I had this idea last night that my character, you know, smokes the entire time and, you know, whatever it is. It just gives everybody a chance, including the writer, to hear it after the table read, by the way, and sit and go, okay, let's go through it. Yeah. Oh, that's a funny line. Okay, that's a good alt, or that takes us in a different direction. It's really been helpful.
That's great. I mean, I've not gone through that situation, but, you know, directors have brought me in for like those little like sitting around on the couch, you know, let's read some lines things, which is really good for a chance, because there's a handoff that happens. Until those actors are cast, I'm playing all the characters.
Sure.
And so I have a performance in my head that works. And if the choices they're making aren't working, then let's have a conversation and figure out what it is that can make it work for them.
And make it better.
And also it makes it, you know, it takes the pressure off so that it's not, you know, there's not a whole crew waiting for this thing to happen.
It's funny that you say about the first cut thing, because in your WGA agreement, you know, we're mandated to show the writer of the movie at some point. But I do sometimes feel, not as a producer, but I did used to feel as an executive, sometimes people just do it to burn the commitment as opposed to genuinely going, hey, come in and watch this. And I think, again, it comes from insecurity. I think we're all vulnerable and insecure, and it's like, I just don't want the writer to say it sucks, it's terrible, and walk away angry. So I'm going to prolong that as long as possible, go through a couple previews and go, no, the movie works, as opposed to bringing the writer back in quickly and saying, hey, roll up your sleeves with us. What did I miss? What am I missing? Because it is a collaborative meeting medium, and I do think writers get the shit into the stick a lot in terms of just being pushed out and showing up at the premiere going, what the fuck? This isn't the movie I wrote.
I think also keep in mind that, you know, directors, you know, all sorts of different talents with directors, but generally a huge strength of directors is not sitting in a chair for 10 hours staring at a screen.
Right.
Writers are really good at that.
Yeah.
And so I think if you find yourself with a writer who is willing to roll up their sleeves and, you know, help out there, some of the movies that have turned out best have been the ones where I've gone in there and I've sat there and done and worked with the editor to find, like, what's another way through this? Like, and let's find something we can show the director about how these things could work together, because writers tend to be really good at that sort of intense focus on, let's think about how we get through this scene.
That's really smart. It never occurred to me in that way.
Yeah.
Of specifically saying it in that way, in terms of just staring at the screen and really thinking about it, that sort of in such detail is so smart. So I hope everybody listening who has a chance can do that with writers in a genuine way. So let's talk about your premiere. You just congratulations on
Thank
Aladdin.
You.
So I love listening to you talk about going to the premiere and what it's like. It's the same exact thing for a producer.
Yeah, no one cares. No one cares.
Nobody ever. Yeah. And I don't do red carpets either. I will say my two favorite, maybe you have the same experience. And again, the preview is another place where I do definitely bring the writer back, because I want to – for a lot of reasons, especially in comedy. For me, the two best moments in the movie, the life of the movie, are the first preview and the premiere, because it's always going to play good at the premiere, even if the movie's lousy. Yeah. And I love the first preview because that's where you learn everything. And everything goes from being subjective to completely factual at that point, because it doesn't matter what I think. Yeah. The audience is going to tell you.
Yeah.
And so – walk me through the preview process as a writer, and then let's talk about your premiere, because I have I think it's just hilarious, because I think a lot of people do think it's for them. And let's talk about what you think really premieres are for. But walk me through the preview process.
Yes, the preview, whether it's a recruited preview, like a big one, or just, you know, sort of beyond the friends and family, where you're having to watch this thing with an audience. Yes, you're seeing the thing on screen. I'm taking a ton of notes about, like, you know, how can we get through this moment? Like, what are some opportunities? But you're really just feeling the vibe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes I'll stick around and listen to that little focus groupy kind of thing at the end, or I will read through all the cards and sort of see, like, the overall data on sort of how people are feeling about things. But mostly it just confirms what I felt in that room, was like, okay, these are the moments that aren't working. And it gets my brain thinking about, like, okay, just as important as what's not working is also, like, oh man, the movie feels alive at this moment. Mm-hmm. So, like, in our cut, we need to be looking at, like, how do we make the rest of the movie feel as alive as this movie? In the first Charlie's Angels, we had a lot of challenges, but we never quite felt what the movie was going to be until we'd cut a trailer. And, like, that first trailer was great. And it's like, oh, that's the movie we're trying to make.
Right.
And we could sort of steer towards that. And then, you know, getting through the test previews, we cut the new opening title sequence, and it had, like, the right feel to it. And so it's all about that feel, and that's why you want to bring new eyes in to see it, because otherwise it's just playing a loop in your own head. You have to see what it feels like to other folks.
And a lot of people don't realize that time stands still in that 90 to 100 minutes that you're watching the preview, which is why I think a lot of times people are trying to rush through the first act, is because generally the inciting incident is probably either your first big laugh or your first dramatic twist or something happens, or the first time they lay eyes on the love of their life. And so since time does stand still in those rooms, again, it all comes from insecurity and vulnerability, we are trying to just get there quickly. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times we short shrift ourselves because we're not – it would even be more impactful if you just have the confidence to take a little bit more time.
We always forget, like, oh, we know what's going to happen. The audience doesn't. The audience is only seeing the thing moment by moment, shot by shot. So as long as you're continuing the spell, they will go with you. You have a good – 5-10 minutes of trust, as long as you don't break that trust before you're sort of revealing the bigger stuff of the movie. And so just remember that, because I think we doom ourselves to rushing through stuff when we forget that, like, oh, the experience of the movie is a first time for folks.
And there may be moments in the first act where there's little things that are laid in that will be more impactful later, mm-hmm. because you know those things, as opposed to rushing to the first joke or rushing to the first kiss, whatever, that you know, you're not as invested in the character. So it's an enjoyable experience, and you got there and you get the good score, but it probably would have been a more satisfying movie had you known the characters
yep.
a little bit more. I mean, that's where I mean, I've been through so many hundreds and hundreds yeah. of previews. That's where I've never once heard after a preview someone go, you know what, let's spend 5 more minutes in the first act. It's always trying to make it shorter, just because you have that painful feeling of like, we're failing until you get your first laugh or until yeah. you have your first twist.
But get your first laugh early on. But getting your first laugh is not the same thing as, you know, as rushing through the first act.
Right.
I mean, it's like, you know, the movie needs to feel, I always describe good movies feel like you could take any scene and just like cut it out of the movie and stick it in some fertile dirt and it would grow into the shape of the movie. It's making sure the movie feels like the movie right from the very start.
Right. And consistently.
Yeah.
And removing the things that aren't working. And, you know, those are the moments, too, where – and also being able to recognize that data and understand that data, mm-hmm. because a lot of times the least favorite scene will be the most important scene in the movie, and you can't just rely on, well, they don't like that, we're going to take it out. No, they don't like it, that they're not supposed to like
yeah.
it. That is exactly what they're supposed
because
to feel.
Because a bad thing happens to your hero,
yeah.
for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so that – I have found that just as exercises – you can manipulate those scores so easily. Right. Just take out the shit they don't like and give them 5 more minutes of the shit they do, and the scores will go up.
Or
doesn't mean it's a better movie.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
It's not, exactly. It's an extra joke at the end will,
yeah.
Gives you an extra 5 points.
It
yeah.
used to be the go-to thing was, hey, let's play bloopers at the end
yeah.
and you inflate your scores. Because I do think – I'm going to have Kevin Getz on here who's like the leading research guy right now. Because I do think research is a double-edged sword for sure. Because you can futz with those scores very easily and create a movie that tests well that isn't very good.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your premiere.
Yes.
You go to the red carpet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do the red carpet either. Yeah. And I think there is this misnomer for people who have never done a premiere before that it's like a big party for us. No one gives a shit.
No.
It's really a publicity stunt. And I actually think in terms of like the bang for the buck, it's useless.
Yeah.
I can't remember. Because it used to be, you know, People Magazine would pick up a cool picture of, you know, Clooney in a tux or whatever. I just think now, I can't even think of a premiere. Like, I know your premiere is at El Capitan. And mm-hmm. I think they did do something at Disney. And Star Wars obviously does these things at Disneyland. We did Pirates at Disneyland, yeah. the first one. It used to be when we did Dick Cook and Joe Roth started it. I think the first one was The Rock. We did it on Alcatraz.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that really got everybody going, wow, you can actually make these things cool. We did Con Air in Vegas. We did Armageddon in Cape Canaveral. Like those kind of things maybe move the needle, but I just feel like so overblown now that it's fun to watch with your friends and family. People are going to laugh at every one of your jokes and clap for your credit. But I just think it's a waste of money.
I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
I think there was a time when it really did matter. I just don't think it matters now. And I don't think me talking to some local reporter matters either.
No.
And so it's feeding this ecosystem, but I don't know that ecosystem necessarily needs to be filled.
Because we're doing a junket,
yeah.
right?
I mean, yeah,
everybody
junket with all that stuff. Yeah.
Why aren't those people on the – it's so weird. I mean, I drove by my office is at Paramount, so I drive by Hollywood all the time, and they're like, oh, they're doing – oh, there's Disney doing another one. You know, and I just don't think it matters no. anymore. You know, the photo call of people in gowns, I think we're numb to it.
Yeah. I mean, like the big friends and family screening or like the actual celebration of like, hey, this movie, that's terrific and fun. And I've been to premieres where like, you know, I like talking to people at the after party, but
yeah.
like that's really, it didn't help. It did not sell tickets.
Lorenzo was on here talking about, we were talking about premieres and after parties, Lorenzo de Bonaventura. Yeah. And that is the double-edged sword of the premiere is you sort of know like, oh boy, this is no one's coming to the party after.
Yeah.
But on The Matrix, he said it was one of the things where nobody would leave the lobby.
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody would leave. So you did have a good indicator of like, wow, this movie seems like it's
going to work. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was a really fun premiere, and there was like, you know, a zillion things of candy. Yeah. And but we all knew, like, oh, this movie turned out really well, and it's going to make a ton of money. It's when you have the premiere, it's like, oh, man, that's
do you feel more vulnerable at the premiere because it's all your peers and your and people in the industry that they're going to judge you, or can you go along with it and relax and hear the laughs and feel they're genuine? Because I have both sides of that. Generally about 40 times during the movie. Both sides, like, this is great, this is awful, this is great.
Yeah, it's always tough. I mean, the second Charlie's Angels, we did the premiere at the Chinese Theater, which is great. It started, of course, like an hour late because they always start super, super late. And the Chinese at that point had terrible sound. And so, like, I could not understand any of Bernie Mac's dialogue whatsoever. It was a really frustrating experience.
Awful sound. I'll tell you one apocryphal premiere story. With my son, who's now 18, he was probably 4 when Polar Express came out. I'm just, dates escaping me, but he was very young.
Yeah.
They were very sweet to invite me to the premiere. It was during the day. They had the party beforehand, which was awesome. They had snow and all this stuff, and we sat, and I was sitting directly in front of Tom Hanks with my son. And that first train pulled in, and it was so loud and screeching, my son got up and left. And I went, oh, shit. I got up and left. I said, Jacob, you got to come back in. Like, they just, no, I am not going back in. We didn't go back. There are 2 empty seats right in front of Tom Hanks. I'm like, oh, shit. Yeah. I was texting everybody like, I'm sorry. The sound was so grating and so loud. That's the other thing. You can ruin it with one thing, and the whole premiere is out the window because you've screeched people out of their seats.
So I think the more nerve-wracking experience, though, is when you're premiering at Sundance or at a festival where, like, you're just going to sell the thing because, like, then, like, like, you know, the reaction you get in that room, any sort of technical glitch, you're screwed. And so that's why you're jockeying to get, like, the best night, the best place, but not set expectations too high.
Right.
It's tough. And expectations are the hardest thing to control, but honestly probably the biggest factor in sort of how the movie's going to be seen.
And I think just in general, in terms of the premiere and in terms of just the overall experience for producers and young executives and by the way, successful executives, is we have to remember that the writers deeply, deeply care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we, in the last 10, 15 years, we've just been so trained to hire and fire writers, roundtable everything. And so that you just become this blob of a bunch of people that have contributed. And it's just so unfair because it is the writer's movie at the end of the day, and we have to remember that, and we have to acknowledge that and feel that and include them in the celebration and include them in the pain of it not working, if that's the case. Because I do think a lot of time we just think it's a big company and we're like, oh, well, that didn't work, on to the next.
Yeah.
And it really is heartbreaking for writers.
Yeah, and every writer's relationship to the movie is going to be slightly different. So there's movies where I was not the only writer, but I was hugely involved, and I felt a tremendous sense of ownership over it. And there's other movies where I had a lot of ownership, and then I didn't have a lot of ownership. And I'm certainly happy for the movie, but, like, it's not sort of my movie. Right. And so, I mean, Aladdin, I'm not writing the sequel for it, and that's good and that's fine because I recognize also going in, like, that's going to be a really hard sequel to write, and I know sort of, like, what the struggle
You've
is
been there?
I know what the struggle is ahead for.
I hope you didn't make a list of things that they shouldn't do because we know that's not going to work out.
No, it's not. So that's it's tough, and especially when you're going in that case where the template is not as clear, sort of like, this is what you should do.
Right.
So, Godspeed to them.
Two things I always ask. One, advice for young – I mean, you do this all the time, and you have 400 episodes of your podcast that is devoted to this. But if you could distill it down into a sentence or two, advice for young writers in this interesting climate that we find ourselves in.
Write the movie you wish you could see, the movie that you would actually be willing to spend your $10, you know, on a Friday night to see, that you would actually get in your car and go see. Because that is the movie you will stick with. That is the movie that people will recognize your passion for. So often I find writers who are trying to write the movie they think will sell, the thing they think is commercial, doesn't matter. All that matters is to write the thing that you actually want to see, be that the teeny tiny movie, be that, you know, a big space, you know, alien invasion movie. Write that movie because it's pointless to write anything else.
And then best day on set.
Best day on set. Oh, God, some really good ones.
Tell me all of them.
I would say it didn't feel like the best day at the moment, but we were like 3 days into shooting Go, and I'd been on set for the whole thing, and I guess I was in the trailer having a conversation with a one of the producers, and this other producer kind of comes in and he says, John, can you direct Second Unit? I'm like, sure.
Wow.
And from that moment forward, I was directing Second Unit through the whole thing, and it was picking up all the little shots that got lost along the way. And it was just so exciting. It was like, just say yes. Say, sure, I know how to do that. And it was great.
That's
and so
awesome.
it was a good day on set.
Awesome. Yeah. Thank you, brother. Thank you for doing this.
A pleasure.
Really appreciate it. And again, you and Craig are amazing together on the podcast. Listen to the podcast script notes. And thank you very much, brother.
Thanks,
appreciate it.
Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks for tuning in to this week's episode of The Producer's Guide. We're produced by Kirsten Woodward and Steve Delamater. I want to answer all your questions about the business, so make sure to tweet me at Todd_Garner or use hashtag Producer's Guide on Twitter. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner. Download new episodes every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.